This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. It's a Friday night. I'm joined by Aaron Bastani. Aaron, how are you doing?
Michael, I'm very well. My connection went just one moment before you came to me. But fortunately, I'm alive. I'm well. And I can rest assured coming to all of you in 4K.
You look quite sprightly, you know, you've got your football shirt on, have you had a haircut?
I've gone for the, I went into my barber, Michael, I said, I want to look like Michael Walker, the best looking man in broadcast TV. He knew immediately who I meant. He said, that's fine, it's a grade one on the sides, a grade three on top, and then we were away. I had the Michael Walker. It's the start of something, Michael.
That is a lot longer than the Michael Walker. He must have made the judgment that you don't quite have the head shape to pull my one off, but we'll see, who knows? Who knows what happened in there? Coming up later tonight, I interviewed Green co-leader Carla Denyer. We will also look at Suella Braverman getting blanked by Cambridge students. Let's go straight to our first story. The informal general election campaign appears to be well underway. And today, Jeremy Hunt delivered a familiar Tory party message and his argument for voting Conservative.
Labour makes a different choice. For them, higher tax is a means to a progressive end. And today we produce the evidence that taxes would go up under a future Labour government. We are publishing 15 new official costings of announced Labour policies that show their commitments cost a total of £59 billion over the next 4 years. That's not even an exhaustive list of their commitments, just the ones they've talked about most visibly. Given their fiscal rules, the only way to pay for such huge spending commitments is to raise taxes by considerably more than the £20 billion of tax increases they have already outlined. In fact, the gap between what they will spend and what they will raise, according to these independent official costings, is £38 billion, or £2,100 per working household.
So when I saw myself after commenting on Aaron's hair, I think my hair probably is a number three at the moment. But when I do go get it cut, it's a half all over. So I stand by Aaron's barber not getting it quite right. Back to the theme at hand, though, the topic at hand. That was Jeremy Hunt. He's saying Labour are going to charge you all this tax, even though the Labour Party have said they're not going to raise tax. Interesting, the experts here seem to think that both parties would have to raise tax if they were, or either party would have to raise tax were they to win the next general election. And that's because they've both pledged they're going to increase defence spending. They've both pledged to increase spending on the NHS. And then they're all sort of imagining that they can make 30% cuts everywhere else. And the economists don't think this is particularly plausible. So they say, if you're not going to borrow money, you are going to have to raise taxes. So potentially Jeremy Hunt, what he's saying is not completely ridiculous, but at the same time, all the economists say the Tories will have to do the same thing anyway. I'm personally not convinced this will land, but you can see why Jeremy Hunt is making this argument. And it's all very reminiscent of the Tories' 1992 election campaign. So back then, they warned that Labour's tax bombshell could mean you paying £1,000 more tax a year. And then that sort of emblazoned on this very sort of epic poster, which has become, you know, quite famous as an effective piece of electoral messaging. Obviously, against all odds, the Conservative Party did win the 1992 general election. Aaron, the Conservative Party resorting to very, you know, classic Tory taxes. You might not like us very much, but the Labour Party, they're going to increase your taxes, so just vote for us. Either party will give you a pretty dysfunctional state, but you might as well try and save your money at the same time.
Yeah. The NHS is going to hell in a handbasket. Council tax is £2,000 a year. There's crap in the streets everywhere. The high street's dead. Public services don't function, but don't worry, you will have slightly less to pay on national insurance contributions. But even that doesn't matter because we won't move the tax brackets. Look, just utter mendacity from Jeremy Hunt in terms of Labour's numbers. And I find it all the more remarkable, Michael, because unlike 1997, Right now, the Tories are running a huge deficit. Last year, the deficit, which is, you know, the amount of money being spent by government in excess of what it's bringing in through general taxation and other things as well, but mostly taxation. That gap, which, remember, was all important in the 2010 general election, defined politics in this country really for the first 6 years after that 2010 general election, and is still very much with us, which is austerity. That gap is £120 billion last year. £120 billion, right? And Labour are looking to, you know, spend tiny sums of money by comparison. And when Jeremy Hunt talks about these very large numbers, he's talking over the term of a parliament, generally speaking. So the deficit is £120 billion last year. You had, quote unquote, a Treasury source, a Treasury paper, which was commissioned by the government. That was last week, saying that Labour's numbers were up by £1.5 billion, or it was less than £2 billion, you know, in comparison to £120 billion black hole. So this idea of they have a black hole, okay, well, even if they have a black hole, even if it's £5 billion, even if it's £10 billion, the deficit last year was £120 billion. And remember, of course, in 2010, the Tories had a commitment to eliminate the deficit entirely by 2015. That is when, in 2010, debt to GDP, you know, was about 50%. It went from about 35% before the global financial crisis. It went to about 60% pretty quickly. Now it's 100%, right? So we still have a very large deficit. We have much higher debt. We've had really stagnant growth over the last 15 years. And somehow the Tories think they can play this card of we're the party of, you know, economic responsibility. Of course, they can do that because of the media and media ownership. And a real lack of scrutiny, by the way. Very little scrutiny in terms of Hunt's top lines with people saying, well, hold on, we're running a deficit as it is of £120 billion a year. That should be front and center, but we don't hear it very often. Also applicable, by the way, with their tax cuts. We can afford these tax cuts because we'll be growing in 5 or 6 years' time. You know, as I've said before, the Chinese make 5-year plans for like 5G quantum computing. The Tories make 5-year plans about how much bigger the national debt will be and whether or not they can finance certain tax cuts to constituencies likely to vote for them next month or next year. Crazy way to run a major economy, which the UK still is. And I hope on that issue of, like I say, the deficit, that the media in particular hold their feet to the fire on it, because it completely discredits this idea of them being economically competent and prudent, fiscally conservative, because they're not.
On the 1992 general election, I was thinking about this the other day. I mean, you probably have the same experience as me, Aaron. Sometimes when you go on, you know, mainstream news, and then you have a very interesting conversation sort of, you know, backstage with a journalist of sort of a different generation. So this was on GB News ages ago. I was on with John Sargent. So he was the BBC chief political correspondent from 1992 to 2000, a very sort of recognizable face. And we were talking about Starmer for some reason. I can't remember precisely what the details were. But he started talking about 1992 and was saying that back then, you know, Labour were ahead in the polls. And he was saying that John Smith, who was the shadow chancellor at the time, was, you know, just this fairly honest guy, right? So he'd said, look, the polls show that people prioritize public services over low taxes. So when people answer these polling questions, they say, I'd be happy to pay more tax if it meant better public services. So he says, if that's what the people want, why don't we be honest and say, we will raise taxes? And then John Sargent said, well, people behave quite differently in elections to when they're speaking to a pollster. And then obviously, you know, people can put forward different reasons why Labour lost that election. But the fact that they had been honest, essentially, with the public and said that if we are going to be able to do what we want to do, you're going to have to pay slightly more tax. I mean, Aaron, do you think you can? Is there any possibility of going into a general election in this country or in any liberal democracy, really, and saying, look, you guys probably are going to have to pay a bit more tax?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think there is a problem as well with the British media, Michael, of basically everybody, particularly boomer journalists, that's not to denigrate older people, but obviously those will be the people that worked on those elections. They look at the entirety of British politics through 1992, 1997. And it's just those two elections, by the way, very strangely. They don't look at 79. They don't look at 2010. They look at 92 and 97. I guess that's when they were young people, right? And they were sort of really cutting their teeth. The 80s were very good to many people in this country. They were very good. If you bought a council home, if you got rich off the privatization of various utilities, if you were working in financial services, if you lived in the southeast of England or if you're in the south of England, they were very good. They weren't very good for other people. They were very bad for other people. But they were very good for some people, which is why, by the way, the Conservatives won general elections in not just 79, but 83, 87, and 92. they were in charge for 18 years because they could build a big electoral constituency about the around the things they were doing. Now, the question is, in 2024 or 2025, whenever this election is, can they reflect on the last 14 years, 15 years and say, yeah, we've built this really solid electoral constituency. Okay, the last year or two has been quite tough, but we had this really solid electoral constituency. We've really looked after them. We've, you know, really improved their standard of living. Actually, that's true for some people, right? We know that's true for pensioners, for instance. We know that's true for people who have really profited off property and financial speculation, although not to the same extent as you saw during the Blair years. So there'll be some people who think, you know what, the last 14, 15 years have been very good to me. By the way, however, Michael, that shows up in the polling, right? That shows up in the polling. You know, people who are over 65 are still the most likely to vote for the Tories. I don't buy that masses of them are leaving the Conservative Party because, as I've said, when it comes to triple lock, pensions, on house prices, they've been quite good to those people. But I think if you look at the basic structure of the economy and who's it worked for and who's it not worked for over the last 15 years, I think it's really incomparable to what we saw with Thatcherism in the 80s. You know, we've seen GDP stagnation, wage stagnation to an extent which is not the same. I don't think you can map that onto the 1990s. That doesn't mean Labour are home and dry. It doesn't mean John Sargent's wrong, right? But I do feel there's a very bad tendency in UK politics to look at everything through the prism of 92, 97. And if anybody offers anything where the state might do more stuff and the market doesn't always work, they talk about the 1970s. You know, this has been a country for hundreds of years. England as a nation is 1,000 years old. But for some reason, the only political lessons anyone's allowed to sort of draw upon are those. And I don't think that makes much sense. Look, people don't want to hear they're being clobbered on tax. I think, by the way, you could be a socialist and say, I want to make some tax cuts. I think, of course, you could do that. You can rejig things. I mean, I think we should have had a temporary cut to VAT during the cost of living crisis to help small business. I think probably that the middle bracket for tax should be a bit higher. I think 38 grand is too low. I think it's bizarre that you can be on the same marginal rate if you're earning 140 or if you're earning £39,000. I think that's ludicrous. I would actually help that squeeze middle towards the bottom end of that and fund it by taxing those towards the top end of that. So look, people don't want to pay more tax. And the point about honesty is a fair one. But I do think you could have a left populist agenda saying the state will do more stuff, providing tax cuts. And I don't think that the prism through which to look at British politics should always be 1992 or 1997. No.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, sort of the political fix is to say we will increase tax, but only on the top 5%, which is what the Labour Party did to great effect in 2017. I know there are sort of economists that say if you want to pay for all this stuff, you probably do need a broader tax base than just the top 5%. But that's a discussion for another day. Let's go on to our next story. Labour and the Conservatives are heading into a general election, fighting over which party will be more fiscally conservative. But they aren't the only options in town. Earlier today, I spoke to Green Party co-leader Carla Denyer, and I began by asking her what issues the Greens will be fighting the next election on.
If you want a party who will defend our future by tackling the climate emergency, protect the NHS from privatisation, stand up for renters tackling the housing crisis with policies to create more affordable homes and give councils the power to bring in rent controls, something I've campaigned on for nearly a decade, and standing up for human rights at home and abroad, from people fleeing violence, arriving on our shores in small boats, to those suffering in places like Gaza, Sudan, and Xinjiang. If you want a party that's not afraid to stand up for all those policies and not afraid to talk about taxes, recognising that the UK has a system that's rigged against those on low incomes, and that we could pay for good quality public services that benefit everyone by asking those with the broader shoulders, the multimillionaires and billionaires, to pay a bit more. Well, you can get all of those policies, and the party for you is the Green Party.
Let's talk about Gaza, because I know that many of our viewers sort of gave up on the Labour Party a while ago. But some of the ones who were holding out sort of said, it's been the Labour Party's position on Gaza, which has been our red line. We're going over to the Greens. And I suppose I want to know from you to what extent you will be highlighting Gaza as a big issue at the next general election? Or is that something that you think is a bit divisive and you're going to be highlighting other things instead?
The Green Party has been really clear. Since October, we've been calling for a bilateral ceasefire, for the release of hostages, and for the suspension of arms sales to Israel while they continue to break international law. And that's consistent with our international policies regarding other countries as well. We stand up for human rights wherever and whenever. And I'm grateful to see the support that we're getting from lots of different communities across the country who share those values. And, you know, there's been polling time after time that has shown that a huge majority of Brits, around three quarters of Brits, share our demands for a bilateral ceasefire in Israel and Gaza and want to see the UK government do more. So, yes, I will always stand up for human rights and the rule of law internationally. And that's a key issue. But so are issues at home. And speaking to voters on the doorstep, where I'm based in my home city of Bristol and elsewhere, voters are motivated by a range of factors. As you said, there are a lot of voters who voted Labour in the 2019 general election who were already feeling pretty disillusioned by the direction that Starmer has been taking the Labour Party. And some of them cite the U-turn on their previously flagship £28 billion climate investment. Others cite the rollback on rent controls, on public ownership of public services, on standing up for workers at picket lines. And those are all areas where the Green Party's stood firm and the Labour Party has backpedaled. But you're right that I think for many voters, Gaza has been the one where previously Labour voters or even members were really hanging on by their fingernails, as one voter put it to me, giving Labour one last chance, even though they were disappointed. And Gaza, Labour's failure to call for a ceasefire in a timely manner on Gaza was the straw that broke the camel's back.
If sort of Palestine becomes a key issue for the Greens, I think, you know, many people who are in the Labour Party under Corbyn won't be surprised if you get sort of charges of anti-Semitism thrown at you. And I want to show you actually a clip. It's Peter Mandelson talking. Just after the local election results, and I want to get your response to it.
The Green Party is becoming a dustbin, a bit of a repository, not only for climate activists, but for disgruntled hard leftists leaving the Labour Party and some fairly unpleasant hardline Free Palestine activists as well. They're all turning to the Greens. And I think whilst in the first instance, the Greens look sort of bigger and emboldened, I think this is going to change the complexion of the Green Party. And I think they will rue the day when they threw open their doors to all these people.
I mean, how do you respond to that? Are you worried that you will rue the day when you, after throwing the door open to, as he says, all these people? And I suppose, have you thrown open the door? I mean, are you quite actively welcoming people who've left the Labour Party because they think it's gone too far to the right? Or are you sort of a bit wary about that?
Firstly, I think we have to start this conversation by hopefully agreeing that anti-Semitism is completely unacceptable. It has no place in our politics or our society, neither does Islamophobia or any other form of racism. So where there have been accusations against Green Party members, we take all those instances very seriously. But our disciplinary procedures operate rightly, completely separately from the leader's office. So I don't get to control the decisions that are made there, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't be part of a party where I did. I do think it is instructive to notice the timing of these attacks when we have just had our fifth consecutive phenomenally successful set of local election results. We have, over the last five local elections, increased our number of councillors by nearly fivefold. We're now on over 800. We have representation on 174 councils, and we went into these local elections in the administration on over 10% of councils in England and Wales. We don't know the final number yet because negotiations are still ongoing in some of them, but we know it's going to be higher than that. So I think the timing of some of these accusations may indicate the motivation. But of course, where there are serious accusations, it's only right that the party looks into it. But I think the fact that the Green Party has taken a really clear stance on Gaza and on anti-Semitism and Islamophobia from the start has perhaps made us a target for some people.
One problem that Labour under Corbyn had is that they sort of never came out and sort of made this clear distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. It meant that they were often sort of firefighting. And I suppose I want to get from you sort of the sense of what kind of politics is welcome in your party. And I suppose, you know, a controversial phrase, for example, has been "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Now, from my perspective, and I think most of our viewers' perspectives, they think that's a perfectly uncontroversial phrase. Obviously, the Labour Party disagrees. Keir Starmer will also say, you know, some pretty bad things about anti-Zionism. I suppose, are you sort of comfortable saying anti-Zionists are welcome in the Green Party?
So let's pick up that phrase "from the river to the sea," first of all. I personally don't use it because I'm aware that it upsets some people, even though I don't believe that the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are using it mean anything other than justice and peace for Palestinians. And I think you're right to highlight the need for a clear distinction between criticism, robust criticism of the actions of the Israeli government, and anti-Semitism, which, of course, it is perfectly possible. And, you know, Jewish organizations will confirm that it's perfectly possible to robustly criticize what the Israeli government has been doing since the 7th of October, and indeed for decades before that, without being anti-Semitic. And this is something that my deputy leader, Zach Polansky, who is himself Jewish, has pointed out in a number of interviews he's done over the last few days, that if comments that criticize Israeli government policy are branded as anti-Semitic, even if they might be poorly judged statements that aren't how he would put it and that he doesn't agree with, if they're not anti-Semitic and they start all getting labeled as anti-Semitic, then that makes Zach feel less safe. Because then when there is genuine anti-Semitism, there is the risk that that gets lost in the noise. So I think it is incredibly important that we are clear about the difference, and also clear about the difference between someone that may have said something that inadvertently reinforces an anti-Semitic trope because they were ignorant of what those tropes are, to someone who deliberately and maliciously promulgates anti-Jewish racism. So a proportionate response, as I say, as co-leader, I rightly don't have any input on the disciplinary process and certainly not in any individual cases. But I can share that our approach is it does take into consideration where that person is coming from. And for the vast majority of people who may have unwittingly shared an anti-Semitic trope, not understanding the impact it has, they're going to be mortified by the impact that their comments have had. They're going to want to apologize. They're going to want to educate themselves and make sure it never happens again. That's going to be, and so the Green Party wants to support those people to educate themselves and give people a chance to better themselves. I mean, I think that's how we would all want to be treated in society. And so it's the approach we want to take as a party as well. And I think that, the statement you may have seen that the Jewish Greens and Muslim Greens, two liberation groups within our party, jointly put out this week that talked a lot about working together to tackle anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and wider injustice in UK and global society. And helping people to educate themselves about these issues is so helpful and constructive for the way forward.
Let's look at other broader policy areas. So I suppose one critique that's put out of the Greens that I think has some strength to it is this idea that you're sort of talking out of two sides. So you're appealing to sort of younger people in the inner cities and you're telling them, we'll build lots of new houses. We want to speed up the green transition so it's even faster than it was already planned to be. But then you've got quite a lot of seats, especially council seats in sort of more rural areas where you're competing with conservatives, and you end up having green councillors who are standing on a platform to say, we don't want new solar farms. We don't want new houses. And essentially, sort of in the countryside, you're a bunch of NIMBYs. And then in the inner cities, you're sort of promising this new bold future where we sort of build a lot of stuff. I mean, how do you respond to that?
I don't think that's fair. And If I may be a little bit blunt, I think you've slightly fallen for the Labour Party attack lines there. We know that that's Labour's approach to criticising the Greens to try and stop us getting elected. It wasn't very successful. We've had record-breaking results. Of course, it's true that we're speaking to voters across a range of geographies and demographics, but we're not saying wildly different things to them. You would be surprised how many, say, you know, a retired woman who owns her home outright in somewhere like Suffolk still supports rent controls because her children or grandchildren are stuck in an overpriced private rented flat with no prospect of ever buying a home because they can't save for a deposit because rents have gone up out of all proportion to incomes. I'm aware of the accusations that keep being put to me in interviews about Greens opposing things, but these are cherry-picked examples. With 800 and something councillors across 174 councils, yes, you are going to be able to find half a dozen or so examples of Greens voting against a housing development or a solar farm. But if you actually look beyond that headline whoever it is that doesn't want Greens to get elected has been putting around, then you'll see that there are some very good reasons in those specific cases. So one of them was a solar farm that was proposed in a nature reserve. And the Greens and councillors from other parties on the same council agreed that putting the solar farm in a nature reserve when there was other suitable land nearby that wasn't a nature reserve wasn't the best idea. And so the solar farm in the nature reserve didn't go ahead. And plans are progressing for a solar farm elsewhere. I don't think that's anti-solar farms or anti-development. I think that's common sense. And I think voters would want their councillors to make balanced decisions looking at the individual circumstances of each case.
In terms of national policy, though, so for me, the Greens' opposition to HS2 seems somewhat bizarre. Right, I think if what we want is sort of a society where we can sort of continue to be prosperous but live in a more sort of green way, then high-speed rail should be exactly the kind of things that Greens are supporting. And I know you sort of say, oh, we'll invest it in sort of different forms of public transport, but this is what's being proposed. And as sort of lots of people, John Stone at The Independent, have sort of explained very well, HS2 isn't just about getting from A to B a little bit faster. It's about opening up loads of capacity. And I suppose my concern there would be that this is more about coalition management within the Greens, where you're sort of saying, well, there's some people who really don't want this railway track to go through some nice fields in the home counties. And so you've decided to have this sort of cake and eat it policy where you say, oh, we won't have HS2, don't worry, we oppose HS2, but we will have other unspecified, unnamed public transport policies. And I suppose that might be seen as a sort of characteristic example of saying, well, we want green development, but also we want to keep the NIMBYs on board.
The Green Party does support high-speed rail, and I, as an engineer, particularly support high-speed rail. It's true that the Green Party has long challenged the specific route of HS2, especially the first phase, because of the ecological damage of that particular route. It goes through a lot of old-growth forest, which has a lot of environmental value. You say sort of, I think you said something like that's the one that's on offer, but it's unfortunately the situation we're in at the moment, thanks to the government, I think is probably the worst of all worlds, in that phase one of HS2 has been built. That's the bit that has caused the most ecological damage because of the particular route. And yet phase two, which was the part that was going to increase connectivity in the north of England, which is massively lacking investment in its public transport infrastructure, and we're never going to level up if we don't tackle that, has been scrapped. One of my fears with HS2 is that it risks just turning Birmingham into another commuter town of London. And if all we have is first phase of HS2, and it doesn't even go all the way to Euston, then I think my fears might be realised.
Would you actively call then for the government to recommit to phase two of HS2? To me, you're sort of saying it would be better to have a train which went both to Birmingham and then also to Manchester and also to Leeds and then maybe up to Scotland. So I suppose you don't want to come out and say, look, if we're going to build this leg of HS2, we should build the rest of it as well.
So speaking entirely for myself for a moment rather than for the entire Green Party, in the few months leading up to when the Conservatives pulled the plug on phase two, I was certainly starting to think, okay, we're reaching the stage now where enough of the HS2 route is built that perhaps we should start transitioning from opposing it to holding HS2 Limited to account to make sure that it can be the best it can be. The Sunak then pulled the plug on phase two, and our Green Party conference, which came a week or two later, passed a motion to call for an investigation into the Conservatives' mishandling of that, in particular the financial mismanagement, but also the fact that the decisions they made around the land that had been put aside for phase two means that they are potentially preventing any future government from picking up phase two if it is found to be viable in the future. So I'm not making a definitive decision here and now, not least because I don't have access to all of the detailed information, but I certainly would want to be open-minded about whether, having built the first phase, are we sure that the best outcome for the country is to leave it at that? I think it's worth looking at.
Great. So we might see a commitment to Northern Powerhouse Rail and extensions of HS2 in the Green Party manifesto. I'd personally love to see that.
Well, we certainly want to see major investment in railways, including in the north of England. And that was another concern with the way in which Sunak rolled back on the proposal for the second phase of HS2, is that there was a sort of initial vague headline promise that it would be reinvested into other transport projects. And then when the details came out, it turned out that that was going to be moving that investment from rail investment into building more roads. Now, obviously, we're in a climate emergency. Building more roads probably isn't the answer. So part of that motion that passed at our conference was about making sure that that investment, if it's not going into HS2, is going into investment in rail that improves capacity and connectivity, especially in the north of England.
I want to ask or finish with a question about sort of Green Party strategy. So a recent Ipsos poll showed that both you and your co-leader, Adrian Ramsey, had name recognition of only 4% of the public. I mean, that was 1% lower than a made-up politician called Stuart Lewis. And I have for a while wondered if this co-leader situation is serving you well, because as a sort of smaller party, it's going to be very difficult to get name recognition anyway. And the fact that you're then dividing your appearances between two people just makes it really quite impossible for an ordinary member of the public to know who is the leader of the Green Party. And I feel like, are you concerned that this is holding you back and you should go for a more sort of charismatic leadership model if you actually want to sort of make strides in general elections?
Of course, I would like name recognition to be higher. It certainly seems to be going quite well in Bristol, where I'm standing to be MP in Bristol Central, but I recognise that it could be a lot higher nationally. I think that's got more to do with the media level of media coverage we get. So thanks for having us on. But unfortunately, we do see that outside of the last few weeks before the election, where broadcasters are by law required by the regulator to give a proportionate exposure to each of the parties, depending on their vote share, amongst other things. Outside of that regulated period, we don't get the level of opportunities in broadcast media, especially, that corresponds to our level of public support by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the Reform UK party, I don't think they've even hit double figures. I think they've got single figures numbers of councillors, 8 or something. We've got over 800. And yet the Green Party receives nothing like 100 times the amount of media coverage that Reform UK does. In fact, probably nearer the other way around. So, of course, I'll do my best in every opportunity to get my face and name out there. But I don't think that our model of co-leadership, which makes political roles more accessible to a more diverse selection of people, is the thing that's at fault here. Our candidates can stand for solo leader positions if they want. It's not that our constitution requires co-leaders, people can stand either solo or as a job share pair. But the advantage of job sharing is it makes it more accessible to people that have caring responsibilities, maybe have disabilities or long-term health conditions that mean that they have so many skills to bring, but wouldn't be able to do the job full time. And that's long been an inclusivity principle of the Greens. Back in 2015, two women stood as job share MP candidates, and they were disallowed. And they actually took the appeal to the High Court to try and make a point that preventing people from doing this, in this case, it was because one of them had caring responsibilities for a disabled child and the other one had a disability herself. They would have been fantastic MPs, but neither of them would have been able to do the unsociable hours that the current role of MP demands. So I think it's very much an asset that the Green Party is willing to be flexible to allow a wider demographic of people to take part in politics.
That was Green Party co-leader Carla Denyer speaking to me earlier today. And we got a great super chat in. Fabienne Katie, 10 out of 10 political analysis as per. Shout out to the one and only Steffi today on her last day at Navarra Media after an incredible contribution to building people-powered media from her sis and Kike, tuning in from Toledo, Spain. That is Fabienne, sister of Steffi, our legendary fundraising guru who has taken this organization on leaps and bounds in terms of our ability to sustain ourselves, but is today moving on to greener pastures. So thank you so much for that comment. Steffi is partly going freelance. So if you're looking for fundraisers, look her up. Let's go to our next story. Suella Braverman lost her job as Home Secretary for demonizing peaceful protesters and provoking a far-right riot at the Cenotaph. But she hasn't given up her role as Britain's agent provocateur in chief. On Thursday, she went along with GB News to try and get a reaction from Cambridge students protesting against the Gaza war. This is what happened.
My view is that there's a very brutal conflict because Israel is defending itself against a death cult called Hamas, which runs Palestine and which is intent on eradicating Jews in Israel from the face of the
land. Quite a few people here. Now, quite often you'll see that they don't seem particularly intent on showing their faces. I don't know if we might be able to engage with people. Hello. Just wondering if you'd like to have any kind of discussion at all with Suella today.
Hi, I'm Suella. I'm keen to find out your views and what you're protesting about.
Nothing at all? No?
Interested in why you're covering your faces. Is it a COVID or a health measure? No comment.
No. Can I just ask, are you students at the university or just from around the area? Nothing? No? Fine. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And what were you expecting? You know, did you think that maybe people might engage a little bit with you? They feel very strong.
Well, these are supposed to be some of the brightest and the best students in the land and taught in the art of articulating their views and expressing arguments in a coherent way. And I'm interested in hearing their arguments.
Yeah? Anyone?
Engaging and listening.
What would be your main question to some of the individuals?
I'm really keen to hear what your message is to Israel.
No. Nothing.
Interested to hear your message to Hamas.
No comment.
Okay. Do you think the hostages should be released now?
Not really.
No.
Is that all right? Hey, we keep walking.
Not very...
I don't know if you would like to have a quick chat with us, sir, at all today.
Hi there.
Go on.
Very nice. I'm Suella. Can I ask you what your message is to Israel?
Yep.
Right?
She, by the way, at the beginning of that clip said, Hamas, who control Palestine. Right? She doesn't, she's sort of made it her job to be this real loudmouth on the conflict, doesn't seem to know anything. Right, of course, Hamas are in control of Gaza. It's Fatah that are in control of the West Bank. Obviously, those students, I think, rather intelligently decided that they didn't really want to rise to Suella Braverman's bait. It made the whole thing look a little bit like a kind of Alan Partridge sketch. While the students didn't want to speak to Braverman personally, though, they did give a statement to the student newspaper. It's quite good. "We are a movement that focuses on our university's link to the genocide currently taking place in Gaza. There are people being deliberately starved in Palestine as we speak, and our university has a role to play in this. We refuse for our movement to be used as a tool for an irrelevant person to gain any political relevance they lost, and we will not engage with them." Aaron, it was an entertaining video clip. I'm sure GB News won't be unhappy with it because they sort of just wanted to get something that looked mildly entertaining, but they obviously didn't manage to get a headline out of it, which, you know, they would have wanted to have smeared whoever they spoke to, presumably. Do you think the students made the right decision to sort of say, we are not going to engage in this, we're not going to speak to Suella Braverman?
I think so. I mean, you know, plausibly, you could have had somebody give a virtuoso explanation as to why she's wrong and completely humiliate her. Of course you could. But I, you know, that's hard and things can go wrong. I think it was a very smart thing to do. I think it's a lesson there for people to watch and learn from. TV wants good TV. That's the whole point of going down there. I sort of disagree with you slightly in so much as I think GB News will be disappointed with it. You've got somebody who was formerly in the cabinet, a former Home Secretary, going to somewhere where there's a protest. You are expecting fireworks. I'm sure Patrick Christie's was thinking that, right? We will see fireworks. We're going to see great TV. And it's amusing. I was laughing while watching that. But it's not, you know, quote unquote great TV. It's more like I felt like I was watching an episode of The Office or something. You know, it was quite cringeworthy. So, yeah, I think it was very, very deftly handled by the students. And by the way, put that in stark contrast to where you've seen people screaming or chasing people down where they disagree with them. And look, it's a free country. You within reason, as long as you're not intimidating or harassing somebody, you can do that. You can very strongly disagree with somebody. You're allowed to do that. But my goodness, I think this is a pretty damn good way to deal with a politician like Suella Braverman. And it says a lot more. And the icing on the cake for me was when she went to the older gentleman and he just had that sign, you know, again, very powerful message that he had there. This is how it's done.
Yeah, the discipline of it was, I think, what was really impressive. You know, they'd clearly made a decision and they were all sticking to it, which is we are not going to talk to her. And I think you are right, actually, Aaron. I think what they would have preferred is one sort of to talk to one person, because obviously they're not going to play the most articulate interview they get, I don't think. I think they're going to be more inclined to play sort of the interview they think it's easiest to cast as unreasonable, because that's what they were looking for. And I think also what they want in those situations, as you sort of implied there, is for people to sort of shout FGB News and like someone to try and knock a camera out of someone's hand. That's when they sort of get to say, these people are extreme and they need to stop. So I do take your point that probably actually, even though it was very funny to watch, they were probably hoping for something a little bit more dramatic. Suella Braverman didn't then manage to speak to anyone at the Cambridge encampments, but she and GB News did manage to entice someone who'd taken part in protests elsewhere. This is into the GB News studio. Fiona Lally is National Campaign Coordinator for the Revolutionary Communist Party.
One of my first questions that I was very keen to ask, I mean, were you at the
Cambridge one, but other ones.
Other ones, okay. And can I ask you what your view is of the events of October the 7th? What do you think happened on October the 7th in Israel?
Well, obviously the camps haven't started because of October the 7th specifically. Right. They're starting, I mean, this week in loads of encampments up and down the country. They've been like celebrating and having to like memorise the fact that this week commemorates the Nakba, which took place 76 years ago, which means catastrophe, which is a massive symbol of what Israel has been doing for the last 76 years. This isn't about October the 7th. And to start with that is just entirely disingenuous, I think, on your part. I really want to say that I think it's great, actually, that you went to that camp today and tried to talk to those students. And you kind of embarrassed yourself, I would say, whilst doing that, because it was a reminder for me, and I'm sure for other people watching, that actually the Palestine movement brought you down, and the Palestine movement has the potential to bring down lots of other Tory ministers and the whole Tory government, and not just the Tory government, I would say any government and any mainstream political party that is backing what Israel is doing right now, which is a genocide. And that's what people are protesting.
Do you want to come? Suella Braverman, after just getting, you know, very politely bodied, just like, okay.
all right, yeah. Because she stayed really calm. I mean, I was actually surprised. I thought, you know, going into the lion's den, that sort of Patrick Christie and Suella Braverman would have been a bit more provocative. It's sort of very sort of disarmingly calm in the studio, it seemed. But yeah, I thought that was a very good answer. You know, saying this is not about October the 7th, talks about the Nakba, sort of like really sort of saying this is why people care about this. And then, you know, a kind of undeniable or, you know, uncontroversial really dig at Suella Braverman, because I think, you know, the guest was absolutely right. Most people watching that at home, you know, maybe not GB News' core audience, but most people who watch it sort of afterwards or who are seeing this sort of on social media, they do think of Suella Braverman as kind of a loser politician who got brought down, you know, who got kicked out of the cabinet for being just completely, like a complete idiot when it came to Palestine protesters, right? No one in the Conservative Party was defending her after what she did. And to sort of remind you, in case you had forgotten, so this controversy was when the Palestine demo or the anti-Gaza war demo was planned for the week, which happened to be when there was the Armistice Day. Now, this demo went nowhere near the cenotaph. It wasn't even on the day of the armistice commemorations. But for some reason, Suella Braverman decided that she was going to kick up this huge stink and say that this should be cancelled. These are really dangerous people, sort of implying the cenotaph needs to be defended, even though the march was never going to go anywhere near that. That provoked a bunch of far-right people, including Tommy Robinson, to go and have a ruckus with the police there. The Palestine march was the most sort of peaceful, inspiring march I've ever been on, and I think many people have ever been on. It's absolutely enormous. She's sacked within a couple of days. So it was her idiocy with regard to the Palestine protest that brought her down. And I think that's that that young person, that member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, brought that out very well. As you can imagine, with Fiona Lally being a revolutionary communist, the conversation did also move on to broader topics.
Let's talk about the broader context of this, which is Suella Braverman lecturing anyone about racism. I don't think anyone's going to listen to that, basically. You specifically and your government have been the architects of horrific racist policies and whipping. You're talking about hatred, you're talking about violence, you're talking about all of these terrible things. I was watching the thing today, you're saying war is a tragedy and all of this kind of stuff. First of all, capitalism produces all of that tragedy, right? Produces racism, produces all these...
I mean, I do wonder if that's the central
that
point, isn't it? I'll let you come on this, but you know, there have been the allegations of racism there. But again, it is actually your main argument for you is you want to smash the capitalist system.
Absolutely, because capitalism produces war and produces imperialism, which fundamentally has been driving everything that's happened over the last 76 years. It isn't just about the last 7 months or anything like this. I'm entirely opposed to the capitalist system and the horrors that it produces across the world in many different places, but also in this country too. And that's what you support.
We could talk for hours about capitalism, but I would just point out, you know, your trainers, your bracelet, everything you're wearing, the coffee you had this morning, the car you
made
drove
by
in,
workers.
The car made you drove workers. In today are all products of capitalism. We're in this studio, we're living in a free and democratic society because we're beneficiaries of capitalism, growth, enterprise and freedom.
No, the only
and
people so who
it's really
from
interesting and what I would
like
challenge
yourself.
You to think about and reflect on is as a beneficiary of capitalism, where you have a lot of luxury comparatively by
luxury.
Global standards, you are actually undermining the very system that has brought millions of people, in fact, billions of people out of poverty around the world and brought education, good standards, good health care, clean water, education, fair treatment
untrue.
To girls,
5 million people,
housing
5 million
and
children.
Prosperity. To the world
5 million
around.
Children every single year die needlessly of malnutrition, of preventable diseases, and you sit here saying that it's bringing
digressing
people
from
into we're here to talk about the Palestine.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Now, I'm going to be controversial here, right? Because while throughout their debate about Palestine, I think Fiona Lally was nearly always absolutely correct and Suella Braverman was always completely, fundamentally wrong, on some of those broader points about capitalism, I do think Suella had a bit of a point. Right now, don't switch off. Bear with me. I'm going to go to two data points, sort of to try and bring you around to my position in case you're throwing stuff at the television. So Fiona Lally mentioned children dying unnecessarily under capitalism. Now, that is undoubtedly true, and it's a tragedy. It should be fixed, right? But Suella is right that a lot more children used to die before capitalism became the dominant system, right? So this is from Our World in Data, a great website. It shows that until 1800, child mortality, this is phenomenal, averaged 48%. So nearly half of children died before they were adults. Remarkably constant in hunter-gatherer societies, it was 49%. In ancient Rome, it was 50%. In Sweden, in the 1600s, it was 50%. In Japan, in the 1700s and 1800s, 51%. Then after the Industrial Revolution, that massively declines. By 1950, global child mortality is at 27%. And then in 2020, global mortality for children is 4.3%. In some of the sort of more rich and equal countries, it's down to 0.3%. So rich and equal, but still fundamentally capitalist. Iceland, Finland, Norway, Japan. Poverty was also mentioned there. And in terms of extreme poverty, we can also tell a similar story. Again, this is from Our World in Data. In orange, it shows the share of the global population living in extreme poverty. That's defined as people unable to meet basic needs, including sufficient nutrition and adequately heated shelter. So the share fell from 75% in 1820 to around 10% in 2018. And the decline in extreme poverty has actually been accelerating in the last two decades. So you can see it sort of goes down at a moderate pace for most of the 20th century. And then in the 2000s, largely driven by China, which isn't a, you know, it's not a neoliberal country, but it is a capitalist country. It goes much, much lower. Aaron, some people might think I'm committing blasphemy here, talking about how the capitalist system has brought a lot of people out of poverty and increased the health of children. Obviously, I'm a social democrat. I like capitalism with egalitarian characteristics. What's your response?
Well, it looks like we haven't been cancelled for a few weeks here at Navarra Media. So Michael Walker thought he'd stir the pot. You know, life was getting a little bit too easy, a little bit too comfortable. Look, I disagree with you on the basics of what you're saying. It's obviously inarguable that infant mortality, women dying in childbirth has just collapsed over the last few hundred years across the world. It clearly maps onto what we might view as quote-unquote development, rising literacy, rising GDP, rising productivity per worker, urbanization. Clearly, these all map onto one another. There is a transitional process which happens. It's called the demographic transition theory. That happens, clearly. And it maps onto what happens with the Industrial Revolution. I would say a few things here. Firstly, and this is really remarkable, and we don't really talk about it enough, until the early 1800s, infant mortality was so high amongst humans. There were primates in the wild, there were other kinds of primate, like baboons, who had better rates of infant mortality than humans did, until about 200 years ago, which is mind-blowing. You know, as a species, we've been around for 300,000 years, for almost all of that, we had a higher rate of infant mortality than like most primates or a lot of other primates. That's a really interesting statistic when perhaps as a species, we get, you know, ideas above our station about how clever we are. Well, for a long time, our babies were more likely to die than with wild primates, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa and Eastern Southeast Asia. So that's the first point. Secondly, The young woman there said that, look, capitalism didn't create these things, workers did. And I would say the same in regards to the really important statistics you just referred to, Michael. You know, for instance, the arrival of vaccines. Jenner does this with cowpox, an English farmer slash scientist, agronomist slash scientist. He develops the first vaccine. That those save, in the end, billions of people's lives, or let's say hundreds of millions of people's lives. Improve the quality of life for many, many people. Vaccines aren't an outgrowth of capitalist development. They're an outgrowth of human ingenuity. The insight of Marx, of course, is that capitalist society
Why didn't it happen before then, though? So if you're saying the vaccine creation was just a product of human ingenuity, why didn't it happen for the previous 5,000 years until we had the Industrial Revolution, which I think it's difficult to deny was driven by capitalism?
Lots of things are down to human ingenuity. We could say numeracy, astronomy, mathematics, language, capturing fire. These are all outgrowths of human ingenuity. Nobody says, oh, well, you know, without the unique economic system that hunter-gatherers had, they would never have been able to come up with basic numeracy. Without the unique economic system of feudalism that they had in ancient Babylon, they never would have understood that there are 365 days in a year and, you know, various cosmological facts. So I'm slightly skeptical of that. What I would say is, and I disagree with you about capitalism, actually, Michael. I don't think it's capitalism. It's markets. And China is not a capitalist society. It's not. It's a market society. But there is a political impetus that's driven by the Chinese Communist Party, which is about promoting a certain kind of growth, achieving certain kind of political ambitions. And if you ask somebody in the CCP, they would say the main difference between us and what you have in the West is that the political ambitions that drive us are not the interests of capital. Our interests are taking 100 million people out of poverty. Our interests are being the world's number one in microprocessor production. Our priorities are, basically producing all the world's steel and being number one in these strategic industries. So we determine capital allocation. We determine problem solving within the premises of market production. Whereas you in the West, you don't have that level of coordination of resources. You allow capital to basically determine its own fate. Again, let's go back to Marx here. What is capital? Capital is value in motion. It's money making money. That is the supreme sort of political impetus that guides your societies. We're different. And what I would say is, in regards to that, what that young woman said, and I don't agree with everything she said, by the way, and I do agree with you that, look, the world's a lot better now than it was 250 years ago. I think that's because of a bunch of things. I would say the globalization of market society, for sure. Features of capitalism, although of course many of the good things that you're talking about are the result of state-led coordination, and that's not necessarily even, you could call it social democratic. I don't even think it's necessarily that. And to underscore that point, Michael, look at life expectancy today. China, Cuba, Turkey have a longer life expectancy than the United States. That's before you even look at certain demographics like African-American men, who are far more likely to die at a younger age than the average US citizen. So, I think that undermines the argument that capitalism is really good for health outcomes. Or in Bosnia, women are less likely to die in childbirth in Bosnia than they are in the United States. I think that tells you something quite important, actually, about what capitalist development, high GDP, doesn't necessarily map onto impressive health indicators. So these two things go hand in hand. I think that's absolutely right, Michael, and I think we need to unpick that. I don't think it's monocausal. The idea that capitalism therefore leads to these really good outcomes on health, I don't buy that. India is a capitalist society. China is a capitalist society. And they've gone in very different directions on things like gender equality, life expectancy, extreme poverty. And so I fundamentally disagree with your assertions there about that's a capitalist society. It's a market society with a very, very unique political configuration, which I don't think any Western capitalist liberal democracy has.
Haven't you just changed definitions there? Because, I suppose the point I'm making is whatever you talk about any country here or there, right? You've got to see that things have really changed since about 200 years ago. So even if you want to have a sort of Chinese state-led, I think it's state-led capitalism that they've got in China. I don't think when anyone calls themselves a sort of anti-capitalist, they're envisioning that you'll still have billionaires owning factories, but you'll also have a powerful communist party that can discipline them as an
market socialism.
Got vast inequalities in China.
Sure.
And the thing, and this all happens in the context of something which changed 200 years ago. And you've said, sure. Oh, okay, that's globalized markets. But that just seems to me to be renaming capitalism. I don't think that young lady on GB News would say, I'm in favor of globalized markets. I'm just not in favor of capitalism.
It's not Adam Smith writing The Wealth of Nations in 1770, whatever it is, and then that happening. There is a configuration of events, some technological, the arrival of the steam engine, some political, the American and French revolutions, some intellectual, yes, of course, people like Adam Smith, but it's like the idea of there's this new unique system called capitalism that makes everything better. No, the steam engine, Michael, creates extraordinary wealth to an extent we've never seen before. Could that have happened under a different kind of political system? Would it have developed in a different kind of way? Plausibly. There's significant amounts of evidence that the Greeks around the first century AD and before then even were creating very sophisticated levels of technology. The point is, because they had a slave class, the incentives weren't there for them to develop it. There is a very different counter-alternative world where actually the technologies we associate with the 19th century are existing by the 5th, 6th, 7th century. Or equally, you have the analytic engine, which was developed by Charles Babbage in Victorian England, the world's first computer, That could have, you know, precipitated the information revolution 100 years before it actually started. That information revolution would look very different to the one that we saw over the course of the second half of the 20th century. So I think, of course, you can't ignore capitalism and the incentives it creates. Of course you can't, Michael. But the idea that all these changes come about as a result of capitalism, this new unique system, no, it's nonsensical. There's a ton of technological developments. There's a ton of changes in configurations of how we run society, i.e. the liberal constitutional revolutions of the late 18th century. You get the idea of a mass tax base in France to pay for the Grand Armée. All of a sudden, that creates the possibility of an organized, centralized state. So no, this idea that it's just capitalism, no. It would be an ensemble of maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 things. And yet you would probably say that capitalism slash the globalization of market economies is one of them. But the idea that that is the catalyst for all that stuff is I find silly.
You know, you're a Marxist, right? I think Marxists maybe have it both ways. So you sort of say, obviously the Marxist theory of history is to say that the fundamental thing that changed, you know, towards, you know, in the 17th and 18th, 19th centuries was we shifted dramatically to a capitalist system. And that is sort of the big explanatory feature of global history is capitalism. And then you list all these good things. You say, oh, no, the good things, they come from different situations. The wars, they're driven by capitalism. But the fact that now we have higher life expectancies, we have vaccines, the fact that child mortality has shrunk, that's something else that just happened to coincide with the Industrial Revolution and development. Do you see where I'm coming from?
Well, I just don't buy that. Penicillin, for instance, was developed by somebody who literally didn't want to patent it. They gave it away to society. So the idea that the incentives behind penicillin, which has saved hundreds of millions of people's lives, that's just simply not true. And also, I think you're buying a myth, which is to say that no good stuff happened before the early 1800s. So for instance, one of the things, and a lot of that good stuff only kicks in later on. So we're talking about improving life expectancy, the distribution of what we would think of as contemporary healthcare. You know, a lot of that stuff, of course, is impossible without the printing press and mass literacy. And if you want to sort of work out where that comes from and when that revolution happens, you have to go back to the typographic revolution, the 16th century. And it takes a long time before you get mass literacy and, of course, the ability of people to coordinate in the way that we're talking about here. But that's not just capitalism. That's building on a previous print revolution several hundred years earlier. So, you know, this idea that, oh, you know, the world was absolutely fucking dog shit until the 1800s. Yes, infant mortality, very bad. And by the way, we do agree on some of this, by the way, Michael. If you look at the idea of privilege, Queen Anne, I think, was a queen in this country early 18th century. She had 17 kids, I believe. She had 17 children. All of them died before the age of 10. So they either died in childbirth, or she had miscarriages, or one died, and I think he died at 10, right? He was the heir to the throne. That was an incredibly common experience for humanity until very recently, right? Just huge numbers of children dying before they reach adulthood, huge numbers. And also women dying in childbirth too. That's a massive, significant change. I will absolutely grant you that, of course. But I simply refute the idea that it's contingent on a certain kind of economic system. Let me invert this, Michael. Would we have climate change if we had a socialist economic, let's say the USSR somehow won the Cold War? Would we have climate change? Of course we would. Of course we would, because whether it was USSR and communism or the United States-led sort of brand of capitalism after World War II, whichever side won, they were still both burning fossil fuels. They still maintained a certain kind of relationship to nature where they viewed it, you know, as something through which you extract value. So, I mean, I would say the same with regards to the technology which emerged at the start of the 1800s, you know, from vaccines all the way through, fast forward to the early 20th century, to antibiotics. You know, the idea that that's contingent on a certain kind of economic system, I think, is as stupid as saying that we wouldn't have climate change if the USSR won. I think, no, that's just simply not true.
Yeah, I suppose I'd just say none of these things did happen before 1800. Child mortality, as I say, I didn't realize how constant it was. I knew that it sort of dramatically fell after the Industrial Revolution, but I'd thought it had been, you know, probably maybe slowly declining until then. But it's basically 50% for the entirety of human history until the Industrial Revolution.
Let me. There are some things, Michael, where if you look at human population, so for instance, you know, the Roman Empire is extraordinary for many things, but you don't get a city of 1 million inhabitants in Europe until London about 200 years ago, right? Rome in the first century AD has about 1 million people. That is not replicated again in Europe until 200 years ago. And there is a reason why, you know, you had a view of history as a Polybian cycles of going up and down rather than linear progress, because that's, if you're looking back at Rome with 1 million people and you're in 16th century England or France or the Dutch Republic, you think, oh, fucking hell, they were really kicking some backside. So fresh drinking water in first century Rome was better than it would have been in England, in London, in the early 1900s. So it's more complicated than that. What I would say is after the early 1800s, you have the Industrial Revolution, you have this huge diffusion of knowledge. And also the population thing, Michael, is also about living longer. And by the way, people weren't living longer. And this is probably actually the best counter argument. People weren't living longer until well into the mid 19th century. Actually, people in the 30, 40 years into the Industrial Revolution were actually shorter and sort of had less muscle mass than they were before the Industrial Revolution. One of the reasons why you have the beginnings of welfareism in Germany, in France, in the UK, is because they recognize actually large numbers of their men aren't physically fit enough to fight wars. So on some measures, yes, infant mortality falls, maternal deaths and childbirth fall, but people get shorter, they're less physically healthy. And there's something called the Engels pause, which is you have the Industrial Revolution for 40, 50 years, and yet standards of living don't improve. They do improve eventually. Why? Collective action, industrial action, political resistance, which says, look, the pie's got bigger, but we want a bigger share of that bigger pie. So this sort of monocausal relationship that somebody like Suella Braverman would have between capitalism equals better living standards. Well, no, without the politics, without the trade unions, without the demands, without those movements, I mean, who knows? We don't have that counterfactual, but they did happen, thank God. And that's why we have the weekend, the 8-hour day and the welfare state.
Aaron, it's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure, Michael. We spent far too long on that story, but it was good. And I will say one final thing. Capitalism doesn't start in the early 1800s. It starts really in the 16th century, which does rather undermine the argument. But anyway, that's for another show.
I mean, that doesn't undermine the argument. It just takes a while for it to kick off. You can't say the Industrial Revolution had nothing to do with capitalism or wasn't principally driven by it. Anyway, let's wrap up there. Have a fantastic weekend. You've been watching Novara Live. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.